you. It's a pleasure to be here. I feel like an outsider. I came here to study. It's a new field for me, so I came as a student. And I hope to learn something. And I'm more optimistic that I will learn new properties of quantum field theory that I will be able to contribute to condensed matter physics, but we'll see how it goes. I would also like to use this opportunity to congratulate the recent Nobel laureates, and in particular Duncan, who is here. I think this conference is really an appropriate way to celebrate the Nobel Prize, so let's. So I'm going to talk about some papers that appeared recently, three papers that I wrote recently with various co-authors who were already mentioned, except my student, Shin, who were already mentioned in the previous talk, and two related papers that came more at the same day, and there's a lot of other papers that I will talk about that. Now, in the past, when I talked about, I gave similar talks, I presented it as a statement about the unity of physics. So it was not just different topics, as Senthil said, that merged together, but in fact, ideas from totally different branches of physics. So the first is the condensed matter 3D quantum field theory route, which Senthil described beautifully. But there were two logically totally independent lines of investigation. One started with dualities in 3+1 dimensions, and the other started with string theory, ADS-CFT correspondence, and quantum field theories in 2+1 dimensions, but at large n. And the logic and the techniques and the tools and these three routes were totally, logically, totally distinct. And surprisingly, they all merged on the same set of ideas. I use that as a sign for the unity of physics, but I guess that in this place, KITP, emphasizing the unity of physics, is not really necessary. You do it here, practice it here all the time anyway. So I will not follow this route here, and I will not describe the historical steps that have led to that. Instead, since I've been struggling with the condensed matter literature, and I want to thank many of you who helped me, and especially Senthil, I think by now we might have crossed the 1,000 emails that we have exchanged on this topic, I thought I would summarize on one slide the main differences between the two cultures. So, or at least the main differences between the way this talk will be structured and the condensed matter literature. So first, these will be, I think these are inessential. I'll be using only continuum quantum field theory. I will have no lattice in mind, so I'll have in mind flowing all the way to the infrared, and we have just a continuum quantum field theory. We clearly throw away a lot of interesting physics, but the hope is that what we get is more universal and it is controlled by fewer parameters, the parameters of the continuum quantum field theory. The second is just because of my upbringing. I'm studying Lagrangians rather than Hamiltonians. This is clearly inessential. And for simplicity, we'll limit ourselves to Lorentz invariant systems. And again, I think this is inessential for the physics that I'm going to discuss. The other distinctions, I think that I really feel strongly about, and I would like to emphasize. So the first point cannot be overstated. All gauge fields and Chern-Simons terms must be properly normalized. This is absolutely essential. We saw that in Senthil's talk earlier today. He had a lattice of charges. He was not allowed to throw in another point in the middle of the lattice. That's inconsistent with Dirac quantization. Similarly, he emphasized that one should have all the points in the lattice. All of them should be populated. You cannot just remove some of these points. So paying close attention to the proper normalization of the gauge fields and correspondingly the proper normalization of Chern-Simons terms, this is essential. All Chern-Simons terms have to be properly normalized. Otherwise, the theory is not well defined. So it's not whether it agrees with experiment or not. It's not even well defined. And when we have a duality with the left-hand side on the right-hand side of the duality, before we say that the duality is right or wrong, first we have to make sure that the two sides are separately well-defined. This is a point that I really cannot overstate. There are also two other things which are slightly more technical. And if you ask me later about that, I prepared some slides. But for the purpose of this talk, I'll just give you the final answer. the fermion determinant, there's enormous confusion about it in the literature. The proper treatment of it goes back to work of Alvarez, Gomez, De La Pietra, and Moore in the early 80s. And in the context of condensed matter physics, topological insulator, this was really emphasized very clearly in a paper of Witten's. And people say that this U1, this fermion couples to a gauge field, people refer to it as U1 level a half. This is really misleading. I will not use that language. But if you don't like this, my language, and you would like to understand this talk or present this talk in a language that is more common in the literature, wherever you see a term for a Dirac fermion, just add to it level a half Chern-Simons term with my conventions with a minus sign. So use that as a dictionary. It's not precise. I'll be using the left-hand side. This is the language that is being used in most of the literature. And the third point, which is important, is the spin-charge relation, and Sentry beautifully described it. He mentioned that fermions have half-integer spin, fermions with half-integer spin have odd electric charge, and bosons with integer spin have even electric charge. This can be described more mathematically as the fact that A, and all, whatever I have big A or little a, this would be something that is called the spin-C connection. Now, you can follow this talk without understanding these two more technical points, but if you want to understand it deeply, I'll be happy to provide more information. So I'd like to summarize two of the roots that I mentioned before in a beautiful paper that was written by Ofer Aharoni, where he mentioned three dualities between n sub f scalars at the 5/4 fixed point, and they coupled either to SUN or UN gauge theory, and NF fermions coupled to some other gauge group. So this is a map or duality between the theory of purely scalars and the theory of purely fermions, and with my student, we added another member to that list. Now, these dualities were motivated by studying the theories at large N. At larger N, the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the duality, a lot of these things can be computed, the free energy, expectation values of order parameters. These are really solvable theories at infinite N. And infinite N is N and K go to infinity with fixed ratio. They also fit the other root that I mentioned, the supersymmetric root. There are lots of dualities of supersymmetric theories. And these theories are obtained by taking a supersymmetric theory and turning on a perturbation that breaks supersymmetry. There were also a lot of other consistency checks of them connected to something called level rank duality, which is a topic which is extremely common in mathematics, where you exchange the level of the Chern-Simons term with the rank of the gauge group. This is considered very deep. It has lots of applications in mathematics. In physics, it appeared in rational conformal field theories, and it appears in topological field theories and Chern-Simons theories. So this is connected to that, and monopole operators could fit. So when I saw these papers, I was actually quite skeptical. And I was skeptical about these dualities, even though I love dualities, I was skeptical about this particular one because there were tons of puzzles. The first question, this was motivated by infinite n, should it be true for all values of n? We know very well that there are examples of theories that are things that we can prove at infinite n, but they are not true at finite n. This is like a bosonization, but this time in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So bosonization in 1 plus 1 dimension is common. This is bosonization in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And how can a theory of bosons be dual to a theory of fermions? And there's something that high-energy physicists call the Tuft matching condition. And if you have some property of the theory, you couple it to a background field, and you ask how the dual theory couples to the background field. Again, we saw that in Senthil's talk this morning. He coupled to a background monopole and explored the response of the system. So how can a system of bosons that can be formulated on any manifold, it doesn't even have to be a spin manifold, how can it be dual to a theory of fermions that needs a choice of spin structure? It has to be a spin manifold and a choice of spin structure. What is the relation between all these dualities and dualities that had been discussed in the condensed matter literature? And these dualities has all sorts of puzzles associated with them. Quantization of Chern-Simons term, time reversal invariance was puzzling, the dynamics of the gauge theory was puzzling, etc. So what's the relation between the two? Another question is, what is the precise statement of these dualities? In all these dualities, we have some global symmetry. And I love, whenever I see a global symmetry, I couple it to a background field. The background field does not have to exist in nature, does not have to exist experimentally, but this is a device to explore how the system behaves. So we have a global symmetry, we couple it to a background field, and throughout this talk, background fields, background gauge fields, will be uppercase letters, and dynamical gauge fields will be lowercase. That also came in Sentil's talk. There was a question about SO3, and the question was whether SO3 is dynamical or not dynamical. We see that here. And the important thing that I want to emphasize here is if we have such background fields, they might have their own Chern-Simons terms. So the precise statement of the duality involves also getting under control the contact terms or the counter terms for these background fields that can couple through Chern-Simons terms. I was also puzzled whether these assumptions are independent. This was an infinite set, in fact, a whole infinite set in the sense of three parameters in every one of these dualities and appear four times. Are these dualities independent? Now, it's very common in this study of dualities that you assume one of them, and if you assume one of them, you can derive others. And you get some kind of a web of dualities, and every time you land on your feet, you learn, aha, that's another consistency condition. It gives us more confidence that the picture is right. So we have lots of dualities here. Are they related or not? And other dualities. So these are the puzzles. And now the talk really begins. It begins with a review of ancient work, started with Peskin and Dasgupta and Halprin. And I'll formulate it in a language that would fit the rest of the talk. This is known as particle vortex duality. And this is a statement about two different descriptions of the same infrared fixed point. So on the left-hand side, we have a theory of a complex scalar field phi. It couples to a background field, background U1 gauge field big B, and it's with a phi-4 theory. And people ask me why there is a minus sign here. It's just because I'm using Lorentzian signature here. So this is this is ordinary potential phi to the fourth, and we tune phi squared to be the fixed point. This is shorthand notation. This Lagrangian should not be taken literally. This is shorthand notation for the theory of the fixed point that we see at long distances. And what these gentlemen argued is that this theory is exactly the same as a gauged version of this, where instead of big B, we have little b hat, so everything on the right-hand side has hats in it, and b hat is a dynamical gauge field. It's a U1 dynamical gauge field. This theory also has a U1 symmetry known as the magnetic symmetry or the topological symmetry, and big B couples to that. So this is well studied. There's a lot of evidence that this is right, both theoretical and numerical, and there are almost proofs. But for our purposes, let's just assume that this is true. So this is an infrared duality. There are lots of infrared dualities. If we can embed them in continuum quantum field theories that flow to the infrared, these are distinct quantum field theories at short distances, but they flow to the same infrared fixed point. And the map between the two sides of the duality is highly non-trivial. The typical order parameter, the typical operator on the left is constructed from the fundamental order parameter, which is phi itself, and that appears on the right-hand side is a monopole operator for the dynamical gauge field B. So this is a non-trivial map. This is a non-perturbative object, and here it is elementary. If we deform the theory by a master, so there's a plus phi square here or a minus phi square here, it maps to the same thing on the right-hand side, but with the opposite sign, showing that phi and phi hat are not the same. In fact, phi and phi hat are non-locally related to each other. This is very common in duality. Whenever we have duality, the fields on one side are given it by a non-local expression in terms of the field on the other side, and it's so non-local that in most cases we don't even know what it is. And there's a relation of the phases, and this is just true. Now, once we have a duality, we have a machine that produces other dualities. And the machine is that we can do a certain operations on the two sides of the dualities. Like you have an equation, somebody proved an identity, you can immediately prove either the other identities, for example, adding 7 to the two sides of the equation, multiply by 5, squaring it, and so forth. So we can do the same thing here. So we take the duality. This is the left-hand side. This is the right-hand side. And now we can do a bunch of things to it. First of all, B was a classical field. We can add the BdB term on the left and on the right, and the duality is still true. We can turn it into a gauge field. So for us, turning into a gauge field, instead of having uppercase, will become a lowercase b. And then there's a new symmetry, big A. We can also use other dualities. So we can look at some terms in the Lagrangian and say, aha, we can replace these terms by something else. It's like when you have an identity, you can say, ah, here we have a squared plus b squared plus 2ab. We can replace it by a plus b squared. It's just like that. So we can plug in other dualities in, and we can repeat. And by using this machine, we can produce other dualities. So let's take an example. So we start with this particle vortex duality, and we add to the two sides of the equation this term. These are just classical fields, B and A. So we just add them to the two sides. So that's clearly still a true duality. Now we declare that B, which was a classical field, is dynamical, which means that we are doing a functional integral over B. So if the two theories were the same before the functional, before we integrated over B, they are the same even after we integrate over B. So we get lots of terms. Don't try and follow the algebra, because I might have messed it up, but it can be done correctly, and it gives an answer. The important thing I would like to emphasize here is that B appears on the left-hand side here in the covariant derivative, so it couples to phi. But on the right-hand side, this B that we introduced appeared only here, here, and here. These three terms are a trivial theory. And they are a trivial theory because the quadratic term, first of all, it's Gaussian, it's quadratic. But the key, another key point that I want to emphasize is the coefficient here is 1. The coefficient here is not 1, the theory is not completely trivial, it's topological. But if the coefficient here is 1, the theory is trivial. If it's trivial, we can integrate it out. So if we integrate it out, we get this alphabet soup, lots of terms. But let me guide you through that. So that's a new duality, which was basically derived from particle vortex duality. If you assume particle vortex duality, this duality is right. So let us first set A to 0. So this term is absent, this is absent, and this is absent. So we compare these three terms with these three terms. It looks almost the same. The only difference is in the sign. Here we have a plus sign, and here we have a minus sign. So what do we see on the left-hand side? We see the Wilson-Fischer fixed point, where there's a global U1 symmetry. We gauge it, and we add the term Simons term level 1. What do we see on the right-hand side? The same Wilson-Fischer fixed point, again gauged, and again there is a term Simons term, but its level is minus 1. That's very surprising, because this term breaks time reversal. So what we see here is that this theory of these three terms is, surprisingly, it is time reversal invariant. It looks like it's not time reversal invariant because there's a term here that breaks time reversal symmetry, but it's dual to a theory with a minus sign here. So time reversal acts non-trivially on these degrees of freedom to produce a dual theory. This is something that Sentil alluded to in his talk. So here is a duality, these three terms, it's dual to these three terms. It's non-manifest, it's non-local, but it's still time reversal invariant. When we add the background field A, we add another term here. We had the time reversal image of that term here. And there is another term that we have to add. What does it mean? It means that this theory has time reversal invariance, despite appearance. But this time reversal invariance is anomalous. For A equals 0, it's an exact symmetry. But for non-zero A, we have a shift by this term. This must sound very, very familiar. We know another theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions that has time reversal symmetry, but time reversal symmetry is anomalous when we turn on a background field. In fact, the similarity gets better because the main operator on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side is a monopole operator. Phi itself is not gauge invariant, we shouldn't study. It's a monopole operator. It's not gauge invariant, but this combination is gauge invariant. So this is magnetically charged, this is electrically charged on the B, and the combination, this is spin zero, this is spin zero, the combination is an object that has spin a half and carries charge one under A. And again, it's similar to the kind of manipulation that Sentil did this morning. So look at this theory. It's time reversal invariant with an anomaly proportional to 1 over 4 pi ADA. And its basic order parameter is a fermion, the spin a half, that carries charge 1 under U1A. So it's not such a big... we can also say that we can deform the theory by either phi square, which map to phi hat square. And then with one sign, the theory is gapped. And the low energy Lagrangian is that. Phi is massive. There are some phi particles. But phi couples to a gauge field, and it undergoes ordinary statistical transmutation. So if we deform the theory by phi square, phi is massive. It's a particle. And it's a fermion. So we deform the theory by phi square, the theory is massive and is gapped, and it has a massive fermion with spin a half and charge 1. And in the other description, it also happens we get the same answer. With the opposite sign, the same thing is true. We still have a massive fermion, but it has the opposite spin. So putting all this evidence together, now we make an intellectual jump, which is not that big. This theory smells and looks like a free fermion. So let's postulate that it is a free fermion theory. So we are going to postulate the following duality. Wilson-Fisher fixed point coupled to a gauge field with a U1 level 1. It's a theory that has a global U1 symmetry. We can couple it to A. This theory is dual to a free fermion. Now, there's a lot of discussion of duality when two different theories flow to the same fixed point. This is very common. One might even say, that's universality. It's not a big deal. But duality is most interesting when one side of the duality is complicated, and on the other side of the duality, we have a free Gaussian point. Then the left-hand side is the answer to the question. The right-hand side is the question. So on the right-hand side, we have an interacting theory, an interacting gauge theory with bosons and Chern-Simons terms, etc. At the left-hand side, we find the answer. The answer is that this complicated theory is really secretly a free fermion, a free gapless fermion, no interaction. That's an exact statement. And we can compare all sorts of properties. How much time do I have? And we can compare all sorts of properties of this duality, this proposed duality. The two theories have the same global symmetry, a U1 asymmetry that couples to the background field U1A. Both sides have time reversal symmetry, which is not manifest, but it has an anomaly. It's not manifest, it's very non-local, maps a boson to a fermion, but it has an anomaly, 1 over 4 pi ADA. The free fermion here, we've already identified it before, it's a composite of a monopole operator times a boson in this complicated theory, and it has spin a half and U1A charge 1. We can deform the theory. We just turn on a mass term for the fermion here, and that translates to a mass term for the boson here. On the right-hand side, this can come with two different signs. The words are different, but the calculations are, but the answers are similar. On the left-hand side, this is the mass of the fermion. So we get different answers. And the surprise is that if we just take the long list of dualities labeled by three integers that I mentioned before, all this was motivated by the supersymmetric theories and the infinite end theory. So this motivated this conjecture about all these long lists of dualities. And you just boldly substitute n equals 1, k equals 1, and f equals 1. This is one of these dualities. So this is the evidence for this duality. It's not as detailed as in the supersymmetric dualities, where a lot more can be computed. But I think this is quite convincing. So if we assume now this duality, a lot of things can be proven by the same reasoning. Because I described this machine that produces new dualities. So given a duality, we can derive many more dualities. So we start from this thing, and now we do the same thing. We plug it into the machine, and the machine produces more and more dualities. So many dualities in the literature can be derived that way. Many new dualities can be found, and we can repeat that for arbitrary n and k and nf in the long list that we had. How much time do I have? Since I don't have 5-6 minutes. Okay. So here is an example of a duality that this can lead to. I'm not going to do the algebra, but on the left-hand side, we find the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. On the right-hand side, we find a theory whose dynamics is still controversial. This is a theory known as U1 level a half. What did I do? I took the previous duality, and I basically turned the gauge field, big A, into a dynamical gauge field. So what do we see on the right-hand side? This is a fermion coupled to a dynamical gauge field. And recall my convention, whenever you see such a fermion, this is what other people say. It's a free fermion. It's a fermion coupled to a gauge field A with level a half Chern-Simons term. So this is a theory that the people who do numerical calculations still debate whether this theory has a gap or not, whether this theory, if it's massless, if it's gapless, what it is. So now we propose a statement. It might or might not be right, but it's a very concrete statement about what this U1 level a half. So it's one fermion coupled to a dynamical gauge field. At long distance, this theory is the same as the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So not only is it gapless, it's a known theory, and the critical exponent of this theory are known to incredibly high accuracy by using various methods. And related work was done by these people. The nice thing here is that, first of all, it was derived from the previous assumption. So it was not a new assumption. It followed from the previous one. This duality, when it was first proposed, had a whole set of puzzles with them. But for example, this is the theory of bosons. This is the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. We can put it on a non-orientable manifold, certainly manifold without spin structure, perhaps even non-orientable. But on the right-hand side, we have fermions. How can there be such a duality? This is a comment I mentioned earlier, that if A is a spin-C connection, we can put both sides of the duality on any manifold. I also want to emphasize this term that is needed. The duality is true only if we add such a counter term for the background fields. Otherwise, the duality is not true. And this can be checked with a lot of detail. We can map the operators, check the phases as we deform the theory. And the left-hand side is manifestly time reversal invariant. The right-hand side is not. In fact, this is a theory that was advertised to break time reversal symmetry because it has, this is the hallmark, this is the theory of the famous parity anomaly or time reversal anomaly because it's a fermion coupled to a gauge field. It needs a Chern-Simons term, et cetera, et cetera. So this theory appears like it's not time reversal invariant, but the claim is that it is time reversal invariant. So time reversal is the quantum symmetry. We can construct other things by other dualities by the same machine. We take any one of these dualities, we plug it in, and we change variables, etc. We can also find a fermion-fermion duality. So on the left-hand side, we have a free fermion. And on the right-hand side, we have a theory of a fermion couples to a gauge field little a. And there's also a gauge field little b, and there's a coefficient 2 here, which I'll talk about in a second, and a whole bunch of other couplings. So this is, again, one of these dualities that the theory on the right is very complicated. It has two gauge fields and fermions and specific couplings. And if you mess one of these coefficients, the whole thing falls apart. And this is an answer. So this theory is secretly free. It's secretly a theory of a free fermion. Now, we could try and incorrectly integrate out the B. Notice that B appears only here, here, and here. So it's quadratic in B. We can solve its equation of motion and substitute the answer back in. This is wrong. It's wrong because the coefficient here is 2. I emphasized before that we did it when the coefficient was 1. This theory, if we just look at this term, this is U1 level 2. U1 level 2 is a non-trivial topological field theory. We cannot just integrate out the field. It is the same as having a gapless mode that you integrate out. You're not allowed to integrate out gapless modes because it introduces non-locality in the answer. Similarly, with topological modes, we are not allowed to integrate out modes where the coefficient here is not 1 because they have long-range order. It's topological order, but it's order. If we nevertheless do that, we just solve the B equation of motion and plug the answer back in. The left-hand side is, of course, unchanged. And on the right-hand side, we find this theory, which is exactly the theory that was studied by all these people. I would like to emphasize that this theory is not the same as the theory known as U1 level a half. This is not the same as the theory of a free fermion with a Chern-Simons terms level a half to fix the parity anomaly. Because recall the dictionary was that whenever we have this term, we have to add to it level minus a half, which exactly cancels that. So in the notation where you add something, it's a different theory. So this theory, U1 level a half, this theory has the critical exponents are just a half. These are the critical exponents of the free fermions. This is of this theory. U1 level a half is a non-trivial interacting theory. This is the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So it's a totally different theory. Also, so that was an aside as a connection to the work of these people. This is a proper way of describing the duality that these people had. All the coefficient, all the Chern-Simons terms here are properly quantized. I don't have any fraction in front of a Chern-Simons term. This is a point that I emphasized at the beginning of the talk. We can, the theory on the left and on the right, both of them have fermions, but if A, little a and big A are spin C connections, we actually don't need the spin structure on either side. Time reversal is manifest on the left. It's not manifest on the right, but it's actually there through a non-local transformation. It's a quantum symmetry. So a lot more can be done. So first of all, there are many more dualities. This is presenting a machine that spits out dualities. It's a lot of fun to turn the crank and produce many such dualities. We can replace U1 gauge symmetry by UN or SUN or ON or SON and produce many more dualities. Every one of them has its own fun stuff with it. A lot of that has been done already. We can add the gravitational Chern-Simons terms. All these dualities need the gravitational Chern-Simons terms, which is of interest also to in condensed matter physics. All these dualities should be done with the gravitational Chern-Simons terms, and that produces more checks on all these dualities. A point that Sentil already alluded to is the connection to four-dimensional S-duality. This is this duality that exchanges electricity and magnetism in 3+1 dimensions. It fits together nicely with the dualities we discuss here. And I've mentioned the generalization to arbitrary N and K, and that gives a precise version of level rank duality. Turns out that it's not true for all values of NF, and there are many more dualities. So this by itself, every one of these could be a topic of a separate seminar. And we also need to check this box because a lot more can be done, which has not been done yet. So I've gone rather fast through a lot of material, trying to give you a flavor of what it's done. It's from the point of view of quantum field theory. Hopefully it can be useful for condensed matter physics. Thank you.
Questions?
Can you please elaborate on the problem with large NF?
There are deformations that don't match. So if NF is too big, you can give masses to all the fermions, and so that doesn't do anything exciting on one side. But on the other side, if NF is big, you can Higgs the gauge symmetry down. But if the gauge symmetry is too small, you end up with a trivial theory on one side and a very complicated theory on the other side. So that's the kind of problems that need to be checked. It actually works rather miraculously for NF sufficiently small. So all these dualities are checked by the deformations. And so you deform the theory and you make sure that the two sides are deformed the same way. That's a non-trivial test, but this test fails for large NF. So it's, I think it's bigger than, I forget if it's bigger or equal than N. Then the duality fails. This only says that the duality is wrong there. It does not say that it's right for smaller values because it's a necessary condition that has to be satisfied.
I see. Thanks.
In the beginning of the talk, you mentioned that the seemingly puzzling question as to how the theory of fermions could be related to the theory of bosons eventually is resolved, provided that you treat the dynamic field, the little a, as what you call the spin-c connection.
Could or big A.
Right. Could you elaborate a bit more on this? I mean, I'm just not familiar with the language of the...
Okay, I'll say...
I know a bit about connections, but I think that's...
Okay, I'll say it in the language of condensed matter physics. I'll try. In fact, Sentil already said it before. He said, if you start from, say, a microscopic system of electrons, so you have a Hamiltonian of electrons, and imagine the nuclear spin doesn't play a role, so you have just electrons. And the Hamiltonian could be very, very complicated. We don't care how complicated it is. If you quantize the system in finite volume, all the excitations will be, and imagine electromagnetism is classical, so we don't worry about that. So there could be charged states, even in finite volume, but all the charged states will be such that bosons have even electric charge and fermions have odd electric charge. That's a property of the short distance theory. And at long distances, we get whatever we get, quantum Hall effect, a superconductor breaks the symmetry, but some other phase of matter, it doesn't matter what it is, it could be very complicated. The same selection rule must be true. Finite volume, no matter how complicated the dynamics is, there's a selection rule relates spin and the electric charge. Now, there's a mathematical way to say that. And the mathematical way to say that is that A, the background gauge field, for that matter, it can be classical, is not an ordinary U1 gauge field. So an ordinary U1 gauge field is characterized by saying that whenever you have a closed two cycle, the flux through it is 2 pi. Now, if you have a system which is, okay, so that's how it's characterized. Now let's discuss spinners. What does it mean to define to have a spinner on the manifold? So we take a complicated manifold, and you know what happens when you parallel transpose a vector around a closed cycle. So it comes back, maybe rotated. So that comes from if you just know the metric. Now you want to define fermions or spinners. Say, when we go around, it should go back not to the same rotation we had for vectors, but it should be a square root of that for fermion. But there's a sign ambiguity in the square root. That's known as spin structure. And there's a condition that we can assign these signs around various one cycles. And the condition is that the manifold is spin. So there are manifolds that are not spin manifolds. And then we can take, we know how to parallel transport vectors, but we cannot consistently parallel transport Fermi spinners. Because when we tried this, we made some choice for the sign of the square root for one cycle and then another, and then we combine them, we get an inconsistency. This is characterized by something called the second Stifel-Whitney class, which is again associated with two cycles. And it's a mod 2 condition. The spin-c connection, this A, has the property that whenever the Stifel-Whitney class is bad, it's 1 rather than 0, the flux, the magnetic flux of A is not 2 pi, but it is pi. Then what happens? There's a mistake with the fermions. The fermions, the spinners, are inconsistent. Electric charges are also inconsistent because the magnetic flux is incorrectly quantized, but the mistakes cancel each other. So this is a mathematical way of stating precisely the spin charge selection rule. So whenever the spin charge selection rule is satisfied at short distance, it must be satisfied at long distances. If it's satisfied on one side of the duality, it must be satisfied on the other side of the duality. And that allows us to turn this A into a spin-c connection. And by doing that, we can take the theory of the fermion and define it on a non-spin manifold, manifold that we cannot even define a spin structure. I hope this was helpful.
So within your set of dictionaries, is it hard to identify, given a theory, self-dualities?
If there is a self-duality.
It's not easy. So there are some examples that Shu presented, and we have had a billion email exchanges on them. Only 100? Sorry, only 100. With Sentil, it was 1,000. So he had theories which were self-dual, in the sense that you can exchange some fields. I do not know a priori whether such a thing will or will not exist. In the examples that he had, he used the imprecise version of the duality of Son and others. Some of them are here, like you guys. And we derived his self-duality using the more complete version, paying attention to the proper quantization of the Chern-Simons terms, paying attention to the counter terms that need to be there, and paying attention to the spin-charge relation. So we managed to reproduce this thing. I don't know it a priori whether this is always possible or not.
So for the on your second checklist, you say add gravitational Chern-Simons counter terms. Is that for finite, because you want to think about finite k, or is it something that's necessary for any k?
What's k?
The level.
No, for any theory, even the theory with fermions, the theory with one fermion or one boson or the Wilson-Fisher fixed point or its gauge version, any one of these dualities, on one side or the other, we might need to add a gravitational Chern-Simons term. This is omega. Just as in some of the examples I had to add, there was a classical field B, but the duality was true only when I added BdB. So, for example, in this duality that was discussed, the closest version is by these people. So we have the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. We have U1 level a half on the other side. But the duality is true only if we add this counter term for the background field, and it has to be properly quantized. Similarly, we might need, I don't remember which case we do and when we do not, I suppressed them for the purpose of this talk, we might also need to add the gravitational Chern-Simons term on one side here to make the duality true. So the duality is true only if we add the proper background counter terms for the background fields. And that has physical consequences. It's not just being a over-pedantic, mathematically-oriented quantum field theorist. This is a... These have measurable So in the case of the Hall conductivity, if a, this is a background electromagnetic field, this is the coefficient here is the Hall conductivity. So this is a number that we should get straight. And similarly with the gravitational Chern-Simons term. So this is relatively straightforward to add to all the equations, to all the dualities, the gravitational Chern-Simons term. And there is no guarantee that we will always land on our feet. Because with all these dualities, every time you do a manipulation, there is a chance of finding an inconsistency.
Question. Are there any checks or consistency checks on these dualities from Bootstrap?
No, no. So there are two reasons that make it hard to check. The first, okay, from Bootstrap, they should get it, but these are, in many cases, kind of very multi-critical points. Sometimes they're very multi-critical. They have lots of relevant operators, so that make it harder for them to do that, although I talked with some of these people. Also, from lattice calculation, Monte Carlo, it's hard because they have both, they have the two kinds of things that are hard, fermions and Chern-Simons terms. So they have both. So this duality is relatively easy because on the left-hand side we have something that doesn't, but this is again, so this theory on the left-hand side is known with a lot of accuracy. But I had some experience with the supersymmetric cousins of these theories. And in the supersymmetric world, which is just a special case of choice of the parameters, it's still as quantum field theory as any one of these, there are lots and lots of checks that can be done. And they are highly non-trivial. So that's why I have confidence that it's similar. But the more checks, the better. There was a question here? Yeah.
I have a question on the assumption of Lorentz invariance. So if you assume less space-time symmetry, like Galilean invariance only, do we get other dualities that are
Well, there might be more. I, for the purpose of this talk, I limited myself to Lorentz invariant theories. I don't think this is essential, because once we have a duality, we can break Lorentz invariance on both sides. Once you establish a starting point, you can derive others. So for example, you can break Lorentz invariants. Now, there might be dualities that are true only in the non-Lorentz invariant way. There's no Lorentz invariant limit of them. That might very well be the case. In cases where we have a duality, so in some of these dualities, we have they go over to a duality between different topological field theories. Topological field theories that look different. And that's known as the level rank duality. So the topological field theory is in particular Lorentz invariant. It's even topological, so it's even better than Lorentz invariant. So that's why I said that assuming Lorentz invariance was in my first slide, was in the list of inessential differences. I don't think this is a big deal.